Hello.
Hey.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is July 31st. I am Brett. And if you don't mind, if you just don't mind, I would like to start with an email that I recently received from a new subscriber named Artie. I really appreciated this, and I just wanted to share it. I thought this was really nice. So after we get the introductions of the email out of the way, Artie writes to me a little bit about his story. He says, in the summer of 2009, I moved into my car to cut down expenses. To avoid boredom, I picked up reading, became engrossed with it, and as I reflected back on that summer, I realized that I learned more in my car and while hitchhiking the U.S. than I did in school, including my college years. That fall, as I returned to my final semester of college, I couldn't shake the thought out of my mind and wanted to learn more about the schooling process. Why was it that I learned more in the back of my van in one summer than in a decade and a half of going to an institution designed to educate me? I stumbled onto podcasting that fall and searched for podcasts about schooling, hoping to get a better understanding of what happened to my education that I thought I received, and I discovered School Sucks. I've led a very, very crazy and interesting life with lots of twists and turns in every direction, but finding your podcast is by far one of the biggest turning points to date. Last year, I worked in the Philippines as a computer programmer, a job I had zero qualifications for doing, and only got because I met some old lady after she scolded me because she almost tripped over me while I was passed out on the airport floor. So in the Philippines, I was determined to learn the local language. Despite having to learn how to program, plus work 60 to 70 hours a week, I took the little free time I had to go out into the streets and learn the local language. After 4 months, I was hacking away at it enough to be conversant with the people. Again, I had to reflect on my schooling years, where I took 5 years of French and couldn't speak any of it. It wasn't the first time this happened to me, and I broke down in tears multiple times as my newfound language skills further reminded me of the true education I was deprived of for over a decade and a half that I'll never get back, though I work every day to move ahead as much as possible. Learning a new language became a joyous occasion for me when I was no longer filling out worksheets and taking tests. And I am determined to show people that schooling is unnecessary to acquire this skill. To do so, I am creating a computer program designed to help the users teach themselves a foreign language. Because of my lack of ability to program, I had to recruit my former boss in the Philippines to work on it with me, which he now does as a full-time job. So to pay for his services, plus finance everything else, I am now working over 100 hours a week on ferry boats in Connecticut, plus many more hours on the side working on the computer program myself. 75% of my paycheck each week immediately goes into the program, and the rest is stored away for when I inevitably need to pull that money out for future expenses involved in it. But I have never been so excited in my life for anything because I firmly believe I'm creating a product that will overtake even Rosetta Stone as the top language learning software out there. And more importantly, my product will become a great example that there are alternatives to schooling for education. So I kept telling myself I was going to get around to donating to you, but I just didn't have the money. But last night, I could no longer buy that excuse. Your show, Brett, showed me what a FAR school is and pointed me to a true education. You also either directly taught me or was the catalyst to my understanding of capitalism, philosophy, politics, and a whole host of other topics that have forever changed my life for the better. If it wasn't for you, there's a good chance that I wouldn't be working on this language program in the first place. This program that has given my life meaning other than being a crazy narrative. I am more indebted to you than you can imagine, but I will finally begin compensating you for the immense happiness you've helped foster in my life. Please keep up the fantastic work you do, and again, thank you for helping to point my life into a direction of happiness unknowable to the person I was before I discovered your show. Wow, Artie, thank you so much for, first of all, sharing all of that with me and for your support. And while I do take, obviously, a lot of credit for the School Sucks project, I have to say that it is people doing what you do that make the show possible at this point, and people having experiences like you have that really motivate me. And I hope you give yourself, for all the things you're doing in your life, I hope you're giving yourself a ton of credit as well. It sounds like you're a very thoughtful guy and you're working very, very hard. I'm very, very grateful that you're out there. I'm grateful for everybody who is supporting School Sucks Podcast or having positive experiences in life because of School Sucks Podcast. Means a lot to me. Let's do a show. So today, I am really excited about our guest. He's 15 years old, about to turn 16. His name is Nick Hazelton. He is the host of a show called the Anarcho Yakatalist Podcast. Yes, Y-A-K-Italist. Yak. You know what a yak is. Let's get a little backstory. He called into Free Talk Live when I was on about 3 or 4 months ago, and this was our conversation.
As we go to the phones and to your calls and thoughts, we'll continue with the 30 things to stop doing to yourself here in a little bit if we get a chance. But Nick is actually on the line here in Oregon. Nick, you're on Free Talk Live with Ian and Brett.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hey, Nick. Go ahead, sir.
I'm a high school student. I'm a freshman. I'm going to a charter school here in Oregon, and I'm thinking about dropping out. I've started my own yak herd, and I'm thinking that that is the way I want to go with my life. But
what is that? Tell us more. What is that?
Oh yeah, sorry. A yak is it's a sort of a type of cow.
Yak herd. Okay, yeah.
That's what I thought he was saying.
I thought you said a yakherd is one word, and I didn't know what it was. But a herd of yaks. Sure. Okay.
How does one start a herd of yaks as a high school freshman?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Well, he becomes an anarcho-capitalist and does not like to conform with society and does not like regulations in agriculture and finds a animal that is not regulated as much as cattle. And then I found a farm in Bend, Oregon, Pine Mountain Ranch. They have a large yak facility, and I bought some from them.
Wow. So you had some savings. You purchased some yaks. What does a yak cost?
It all depends on age and gender. I got 4 yaks for two pregnant cows and 2 bull calves for about $2,000. I did not have a savings for this. I actually am now in debt, but
how does one get a loan as a freshman in high school? Parents?
Parents.
Okay.
Yes.
So they're behind you on this.
Yes.
Awesome story so far.
Yeah. Well, what is it your plan? I mean, what does one do with a yak? Does one slaughter a yak and make yak meat? What's your plan to profit from the yaks?
Yeah, mostly meat. I'm thinking about dairy. Nobody in the Americas, South and North, are selling commercial milk. So I would be the first yak dairy if I can do it.
Wow.
I would like to do that.
A big dream.
It's hard, but yeah.
So,
and then also hair.
Yeah. So school is really not, it's kind of probably taken away from this stuff that you're really into right now, right?
Definitely.
How long have you been thinking about dropping out?
About a month.
All right. So obviously you're an extremely smart young man. So I would guess that you have considered the possibility that by the time you're 16, maybe you might not be interested or as committed or as passionate about the yak herding anymore. Do you worry that, or has anyone suggested that you should worry about maybe erasing some of your options? I know you're just listening, but I'm throwing up air quotes with my fingers, that school creates. And you know, I mean, there are obviously real things to think about because it is a huge decision. And obviously, I would like to see nobody going to government school at your age. But I understand that, you know, we live in a different kind of world than what I envision. So, yeah, I mean, how much planning, how much thought have you put into this? Have you gone through the what ifs?
I've gone through it a little bit. I've talked to my parents about this. I've talked a little bit with our college planner person at school.
Mm-hmm.
I've got great test scores. I am pretty smart. I'm not trying to brag. I have almost all straight A's. I have a 4.0.
You're a 14-year-old yak farmer. Yeah, you're doing great for sure.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Well, what's the parents' response when you talk to them?
Their response is, well, if you do this, you're not going to be able to get back into this charter school, and you're not going to be able to go to college if you don't get a diploma. And I'm thinking that I could go to almost any college I'd want, with the grades and test scores that I have. So I am really closing a lot of doors to do it, but I am really not interested in school. It's not something that I like. I don't like learning what they want me to learn. It's just not interesting, and I don't think that I would use it unless I did end up going to some nice school, becoming a lawyer or something.
Sure. I'll tell you, these Ivy League schools, you know, they like stories. I used to be a college consultant, and I was working with this girl who was from South Vietnam and had, you know, just wasn't brilliant, right? But I was helping her with the admissions process for Harvard because Harvard likes those kinds of stories. Now, obviously, the colleges also consider things like ethnic diversity. That's important. But, you know, a good story that a 17 or 18 year old can bring to a pretty decent school can go a long way. You know, she was older than, I mean, this was like 2006 that I was doing this, and she was in her mid-20s. So she, or maybe late 20s, early 30s, she had lived through the Vietnam War, and she had a story. Now, I dropped out of high school when I was a freshman. To be a yak herder is quite a story, especially if you're successful at doing it. So the idea, I mean, yeah, there is the reality that it might close some doors, that it might make it harder to get back on a college track. Just being a yak farmer doesn't open the door of every Ivy League school in the country, that's for sure. So yeah, you might certainly be creating some challenges for yourself. But I think there's people that you can talk to. There's endless resources for this today. I encourage you to check out, you know, my website, schoolsucksproject.com, and you can hook up with some people there. You can hook up with me directly, and, you know, maybe we can give you some advice, or we can provide some resources, because, yeah, it's a tough decision to make right now, but, you know, the more information...
I feel like he should follow his instincts here. I mean, he's interested in doing the farming thing. He's not getting any of that at school. He's not liking the school, and the parents are supportive. So
yeah,
if your parents are willing to support your choices on this, I say go and, you know, set yourself free of this and do your own education and the things that you want to learn on school.
And just get as much information as you can to prepare yourself for those challenges.
Good luck, Nick. Thanks for the call tonight. We'll see you tomorrow at freetalklive.com.
Thank you. Bye.
So good news. Nick did wind up checking out School Sucks podcast. He's actually at this point heard a lot of our shows. He said he listened to the permaculture series, the autonomy through agorism. And he also said he really enjoyed some of the stuff with Thaddeus Russell. So that's terrific. And I'm really excited that he's doing his own show. I'm really appreciative towards Michael Dean, who helped Nick get set up and helped him work on a podcasting voice. And this is a very interesting conversation. There are a couple places where I wish I'd spoken up a little bit more when we were talking about some of Nick's ambitions. And I say that because I think there's a lot of people who are in this situation where they want to get the hell out of school. Obviously, totally understandable, right? A lot of those students might even be wanting to do that with a passion in mind. I would say to all of them, don't resign yourself to poverty to pursue what's important to you. I don't think that is a choice that you need to make. I think about my own situation back in 2008, 2009, where I was making a good chunk of money. I wish I had a little bit more of it saved, because when I started a tutoring business in the beginning of 2009, and then I started the podcast about 7 months later, if I had had, say, I don't know, $20,000, that's a realistic number, $20,000 saved at that point, man, what could the show have been right from the get-go? And I hate to admit this, but in the beginning, I almost didn't want to do too much research. I didn't want to get overwhelmed by what it would take to make a really professional podcast right from the beginning. I really just wanted to get started and use that, use some initial successes to motivate myself. I knew if I got bogged down in research about microphones and mixers and compressors, I might have just said at the time, oh, this is too much and I don't have the capital and I don't have the knowledge. So I just started a crappy little podcast with a $10 microphone from Radio Shack. You know what Radio Shack is? Have you heard about this place? They're still in business. I drove by one the other day. I don't know how they do it, but they're there. So anyway, I went to Radio Shack, purchased a $10 mic that I could put over my ear, and it had that little thing that came in front of your... That was how I started the show. And then I got like a dynamic stick mic. And then after about 20 episodes of that, I got a nice upgrade from Stefan Molyneux, who gave me one of his old mics. And we were off and running with, or on our way anyway, to having a decent quality show. I'm glad I just got going, right? And I, at the time, I didn't know. I thought the podcast would just be a hobby. But if I had known from the beginning that this was going to be such an important project for me, man, I would have done more research and planning. And man, I would have had a nicer pile of money to sit on in the beginning. So, yeah, this work, whatever kind of passions we're pursuing, it can be difficult. But if you're young enough and you can just be patient, you know, you really know what you want to do, having that startup capital can obviously make a tremendous difference in minimizing frustration, in opening doors. And remember this too, if you're living in a way where your most basic needs are taken care of, you can be so much more present with the work that you care about so much in your life and the relationships that matter to you. So something to think about. I know school is painful. Gosh, I know school is painful. So I just wanted to insert that if there's other people in Nick's position who are thinking about this, you know, make sure you have a plan. The more you can make yourself comfortable before you're doing these things. We also bring up a conversation I had with Jake DeSillis a while ago about why the teenage years, the high school years, such a great time for entrepreneurship, because you have the room to fail. You have the cushion to land on. So yeah, this is a great conversation with Nick, hopefully the first of many. Towards the end of it, we start to get into philosophy a little bit. Nick is a self-described nihilist, so you know we're going to have to talk about that. And because we ran out of time, I invited him back to have a conversation more focused on philosophy, particularly objectivism, which Nick admitted he is completely new to. So, hey, School Sucks Podcast turns 5 next week. How about that? Some more stuff is coming soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Here's the discussion with Nick Hazelton, the anarcho-yacatalist. Enjoy. Okay, everybody, I'm very pleased to welcome to School Sucks Podcast for the very first time, Nick Hazelton. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure, my pleasure. So we first talked, I think it was like 3 or 4 months ago, you called into Free Talk Live. At the time, you were 15. Now you're 16, correct?
Almost 16. I'll be 16 next month.
Oh, just in time for back to school. And yep. That's one of the things that we are actually going to discuss today. So when you called into Free Talk Live, what you expressed to me, and I believe it was Ian was there, at least Ian was there with me, you had developed this interest in yak herding, and you found that schooling was getting in the way of it, and you had been at that point for about a month starting to investigate the possibility of leaving school, correct?
Yes.
There's a lot of questions that I have in what we just covered right there, but first of all, what motivated you to move from, you know, regular freshman or sophomore in high school to this interest in yak farming?
Part of it is my political ideals of anarchism.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of being independent, especially from government. And I mean, I'd really like to be independent from my parents as well. So I'm looking into being a sustainable farmer because I really like to be able to grow my own food, kind of live without having to rely on other people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Something we've been encouraging a lot on the show in recent months. And even though it's not possible for me right now, I'm certainly very supportive of the idea. I think the more people that can do that, the better. It's not really, I don't think it's going to bring the state down, but it certainly gives people more independence and more self-sufficiency. So those are not, from my experience anyway, not to be so cynical, but they're not terribly popular ideas in these schools. So in addition to where you're at now, how did you get there? How did you find this philosophy that you're currently embracing?
My father is somewhat of a small government libertarian. Mm-hmm. I don't really speak for him, but that's what I got from him when I was younger. And I followed that through, but I kept thinking, got tired of mainstream media, started looking into other outlets. I looked up Freedom on I think the TuneIn app, found Freedom Fiends and LRN, Liberty Radio Network. Started listening to the Freedom Fiends. They convinced me to start listening to Liberty Radio Network and really kind of built those ideas, especially. And I kind of got tired of everything that the government was doing. I realized, well, school isn't really working out for me. I don't want to do what the state wants me to.
Yeah.
I'm going to look into something else.
So in your situation, there's three groups of people that you can bring these ideas to, right? One, I would assume that the first group you would want to talk to would probably be peers, and another group would be parents, and then, or, you know, other involved family members, and then teachers. So I wanted to walk through each one of those as you started to discover these things. I mean, I certainly remember for me how exciting it was and how I wanted to share all of this stuff with people that I cared about, whether they liked it or not. So did you try to bring this into school, into your social circle, and start talking to people about what you were learning?
Yes. I've always been somewhat interested in politics, and people know me for that.
Yeah.
This year, I had a great opportunity to start talking about it with a class I had. It was a contemporary world issues class where it was basically just a discussion for an hour and a half. And I got to really talk about that with my peers and my teacher, and that was great.
You have some fun stories or not so fun stories about some of the interactions or debates or anything that happened? Did you win anyone over?
I have softened people to the ideas. I don't think I've really won anybody over. My teacher, I don't speak for him either. It seems like he's definitely warmed up to the idea of anarchism.
Yeah, tell me more about that. Like, what are some things you've seen as far as changes?
He kind of had the same objections to it. Well, who would handle security? He wasn't, I mean, he's a little bit more smarter than most people. He did not ask who would build the roads.
Yeah.
Kind of got that immediately. Now, who would do security? Who would be helping out people with the welfare state? Everything like that. And right now, I think I've got him to the point where, you know, prohibition doesn't work. Laws don't really help people. I think he understood that before. I think his only objection now is, what do you call it, the arguments. You know, who would settle these arguments?
Oh, like arbitration.
Yes.
Like the absence of a court system. Sure, yeah. Peers, anyone right there with you at this point?
I've got a few people that are like, yeah, I think I like what you're saying, Nick. They're not as involved in this sort of philosophical ideals, you know, they don't like to talk about it as much.
Right. So they it's a question of maybe motivation with some of
yes.
them. Yeah, absolutely. So third, and perhaps most importantly, because this is going to move us into the discussion of you wanting to leave school, your parents, how receptive have they been generally to your embrace of anarcho-capitalism?
My parents have been actually really supportive. My dad, he's the person that I throw all my arguments at.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets all that. And I think he, you know, I don't speak for him. He still identifies as being the elite.
Yeah.
I think he's saying that jokingly. I hope so.
Right.
And I think my mother is warming up to the idea. At least I'd hope too. The rest of my family is doing, you know, I've convinced my grandfather and my great uncle, and the rest of the family is slowly coming along, I think.
You have to understand what a tremendous success story this is, because a lot of people will obviously go to family first and try to have these conversations and try to share these ideas and eventually walk away from those experiences feeling quite discouraged. So can I ask you a little bit about your approach when, you know, one of these conversations comes up and you want to insert these ideas? How do you do it? I mean, I know it's probably a little bit different with everybody, but if you have an example or two, I would love to hear about some of your successes.
Yeah. So this morning, I actually had a conversation with one of my friends.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I wish Romney had gotten elected.
Okay.
I said, oh, really? And he knows that I'm an anarchist. And so I didn't really slowly get into it, but I said, well, I mean, what's the difference between Mitt Romney and Obama? Blah, 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 blah. And then that's where we got into, well, maybe we shouldn't have a president at all.
How did you take him there? You sure he wasn't just provoking you with a statement like that? That's pretty provocative. Mitt Romney should be president.
I can't remember exactly how we got to that point. Maybe he was and I didn't notice, but I don't think so. I think we were we were talking about Israel and Palestine,
mm-hmm.
I believe. But we did have a logical discussion. He's one of my friends that I enjoy talking with. He can put up a good argument.
Okay. You're at this place politically, right? And you sound like you've had some success in, you know, not only making these ideas concrete for yourself, but some opportunities to build confidence and expressing them to other people. During this process, or maybe as a result of this process, you start to think more about sustainable and independent living. I can't imagine, and I could be wrong, but I can't imagine that you went into this pursuit of yak herding completely blindly, did you? I mean, did you have any prior experience on a farm or anything like that?
Yes, I live on a farm, I guess you could say. We used to raise a lot of produce, not a lot of animals. Mm-hmm. We had chickens. We've always had chickens. We've got quite a bit of acreage, of field, and my cousins who live down the road are cattle ranchers. So I kind of grew up around that. And when I was about fourth grade, I started into 4-H. So I've always enjoyed working with animals.
Okay, and so you had like a somewhat good foundation for doing this then.
Yeah.
Now, how long have you been at it?
I got my yaks in March, I believe, March or April.
Yeah.
And I've been studying them for about a year before that.
Yeah.
Kind of planning on, okay, how will we do this? I've been working with my father. He's right in there with me with being sustainable. And we kind of thought, well, okay, we have this land, we better put it to use. We planned out how we can kind of do that and decided, well, or I decided I wanted to do yaks over cattle because they're exotic and a little bit more sustainable in my mind.
So this is happening on land that's owned by your family, right?
Yes.
And how? Tell me a little bit about the plan you formulated to break that dependency as soon as possible. Because I know, like you said, when we talked on Free Talk Live, I think that was back in April, that you obviously, because of your age, you had to take a loan from them. And, you know, you're working off their land, but obviously you're doing this and you're wanting to learn this with the goal of independence. So can you tell me a bit about that process as you see it going forward?
Yeah. So yeah, I do have a loan with my parents. I am using their land. And my plan is I will eventually, when I pay off that loan, I'll start trying to make more money with the herd as it gets bigger and with my other farming adventures with hogs and maybe a little bit of produce.
Yeah.
And as I start making money, I'd like to move out of the house, still on their property, but build my own little yurt or whatever at the edge of the property on the other edge of the field, pay rent to them, or maybe buy that piece of land, which would be maybe too expensive. I don't quite know yet. But my plan is to eventually move out when I start making money, and then I would like to drop out of school when that happens.
Absolutely. So yeah, I want to get into that in a minute. So far, from the months you've been doing this, how are you feeling about it? Is it generally a feeling of success or frustration or some mixture of the two?
I'd say it's a mixture of the two.
Yeah.
I'm not as close as I would like to be, but I've definitely made steps into being on my own. I have these animals and I've been working with them. I think I have a system worked out for how I rotate them and how I feed them and whatever, to a point where I don't really need help and I still use my family's help because mm-hmm. it's useful.
Yeah.
But I think that if I really had to, I could take care of those animals as long as I had some other form of income.
So you're in Oregon, and am I saying that right? If I out here in New Hampshire, we say Oregon. Is that...
Yeah, it's Oregon.
Yeah, someone said it was Oregon. I said, no, it's not, you're missing syllables. But I just wanted to be true to the pronunciation, so I think I was close enough. And are you doing this completely as an agorist operation, or are you trying to be mindful of whatever the laws are? I'm guessing if you came from a family that has this experience, that was at least a recommendation that was made to you, right?
Yes, I would like to stay in code and regulations. I don't want to be messed with by the government.
Yeah. And do you know anything about like that going wrong, people around you getting in trouble, what that looks like, how closely it's watched? I'm just curious.
Nobody in the yak business has had any complaints as far as I know.
Yeah.
With intervention. Nobody really does anything other than raise them for meat and hair.
Yeah.
I would like to get into dairy, which nobody does. And part of the reason is it's hard to get up the code and start your own little dairy. Especially to compete with subsidized cattle dairies.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
So I would like to, if I can, I'd really like to stay with that. And I'm not as involved in the organic farming as I'd like to be. I don't know anybody personally who has ever been really harassed by the government. I have heard stories of people here in Oregon that have been in trouble for feeding their pigs some sort of food. I can't remember the exact story, but I've heard of people being harassed by the government because of their farming practices. And I would like to make sure I don't.
Isn't like feeding them dairy an issue too?
Any animal products.
Any animal products. All right, I gotcha. So with all this in motion, one of the central piece of your call to Free Talk Live when we talked before was this desire that was relatively new at the time to drop out of high school. So as 4 months have gone by and you've seen some progress and you've seen some success and maybe gotten some feeling of independence through what you're doing, where are you at with that process? Because being about to turn 16, I'm guessing that's the legal age to be able to make that decision for yourself in Oregon?
I think it's 17.
Oh, all right. Yeah, where are you at with that? Is that desire stronger at this point?
Yes. I've had more people tell me that I shouldn't do it, which just makes me really want to do it more.
Yeah, yeah. Can you tell me about some of those conversations? Like, who were they with and what did they say and how did you respond?
Sure. One of them was with one of my close friends' father. He works at a college here, OSU, and he works a little bit with the business side of that, whatever it is, the degrees. He works at the school of business. And he was kind of, he did this very craftily. I have to say, I appreciate the way he did it. He was not very outright with it. He sort of eased me into talking about getting a small business degree and why that would be useful. And then he started going after me about why I should not drop out of high school. Because everybody knows I'm going to drop out of high school by now. That I know.
Well, go ahead.
He was talking about that. My mother was there too, and they both started getting after me about that. And at the time, I did not want to argue. I was doing other things. So I said, okay, maybe. So I've had several conversations like that where I just don't want to argue with people because it's kind of useless, I think. I feel like I don't need other people's approval. And
yeah.
I do appreciate the advice, but I'm going to do what I want anyway.
Would you say if you had to rate the advice you've been given, the most compelling piece of advice would be because you won't be able to get into college, which I'm guessing is what the essence of that argument was, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So anything else? Any other objections that are memorable?
No, I mean, a few of my friends have called me stupid, which is really funny, but.
Yeah, I understand that. And I guess at this point that if you do find yourself in one of these conversations, I mean, I think about the things that, you know, if I was in this situation, when I was 16, 20 years ago, I didn't even see how it would have been an option. I hated school. Unfortunately, it was a different world and I had a very different mindset than you at the time. And I didn't have any ambition to do anything productive. You know, I couldn't see how, and really I wasn't looking, but obviously the tools weren't there to look as well as we can today at how big and filled with opportunity the world actually was. You know, all I saw pretty much was lockers and cinder blocks, and that was not very motivating for me. But I wanted to get the hell out of there. And as time has gone on and I've worked with more and more students, I've tried to formulate at least some bullet points. You know, they're pretty basic and maybe even common sense for people who do have this desire, but also have the motivation to do something more productive that, I mean, which could be just about anything, but that would be seen as more productive, understood as more productive by people who maybe don't know what you and I know about, you know, the realities of government schools. So do you feel like you could clarify your reasons? If somebody, if you found yourself in one of these conversations with somebody with objections, you could clarify your reasons for wanting to drop out?
Yeah.
And how would you do that?
So what I would say is right now, I'm a very smart person. I'm a smart kid. I've gotten almost all A's. I've got a 4 on an AP test. I'm smart. Mm-hmm. And I've done this, a lot of it, without a whole lot of schooling. A lot of the stuff I've learned is on my own. I do mm-hmm. my own podcast. I have studied philosophy enough to be able to talk about it with people. You know, I think about these things more than most adults do. I'd say that I can defend myself to say that I'm fairly mature. I've got this business to be, I'm starting it. I haven't made any money off it yet, but I have some experience in farming with 4-H. It's something that I think is certainly I'm able to do.
Okay. Now, I'll jump into the shoes, if we can here for a minute, of somebody who wants you to stay in school. And I would say that, oh my goodness, well, if you're performing so well there, aren't you squandering an opportunity to get into a great college that's going to open up more opportunities to you? Like, it'd be one thing if you were like really struggling and school wasn't serving you at all, but it seems like if you're performing so highly there, this would be like an opportunity you wouldn't want to turn your back on.
Yeah, so I'd say that is, college right now, I think, is somewhat of a scam. I don't need a college degree. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a lawyer. I don't want to be a CEO of any company. I don't need a college degree from what I'm planning on doing. Yes, mm-hmm. it would be great for me to use my wit to do something like that, maybe. But it's very hard to make it out and be self-dependent while having a job like that, like a lawyer or something, which is what people have recommended to me. And I don't think college is that great of an option because it costs so much money. I think I'd rather be making $6,000 a year and grow my own thing than being $40,000 in the hole and relying on the government.
Yeah, I can all right, so let's jump out of this for a minute and I'll just tell you a little bit about, you know, my experience. Being 20 years older than you, I was really, until relatively recently, on that track to be plugged in to that world and really seeing the things, at least from, you know, the financial point of view, like seeing how you get trapped there, you know, and I was almost trapped there and it was a little bit of work to get out of that. And it was a lot of frustration initially to do what I wanted to do, to have to give up some of the things that I used to take for granted. I still struggle with that. But in recent months, I've had some experiences, some observations, I guess I would say, that have made me very grateful about the freedom that I have. And in some way, there's a lot of freedom that I don't have. But a lot of this freedom I worked for, you know, to not only get as much freedom, not total freedom, but from some of my own issues, you know, like really, really struggling with managing my own time and managing my productivity in a, most importantly, like in a stress-free way. And I felt like I made some strides there. And also with the way that I'm able to work and the way that I'm able to essentially be my own boss, even though there's, you know, thousands of people that I like to think I have to answer to with the show to a certain, you know, not all individually, but as an audience, that kind of freedom of mobility and that kind of freedom of time for me is really, really important. I know people do it and I know people are used to it, but I can't even imagine going back to the other world of being like a lawyer and being drawn into every luxury that a profession like that could provide. Not that there's anything wrong with it. And some people might be able to handle that kind of stress much better than I can right now. But that's just not for me. And I'm really grateful for some of the freedoms that I have. It's certainly not a perfect life. There's lots of things that I would like to see, you know, more stable, more comfortable in certain areas. But I will say, looking back and considering some of the things I've done, there are many reasons why I'm very happy to be where I am now. So I completely understand what you're saying. you can respond to that if you want, or I can give you another objection.
I think that's great what you said, but yeah, go ahead with another objection.
Sure, sure. Okay, let's see. What if, like, you're really into this right now at 15? What if you leave school, you cost yourself, and again, completely in the shoes of somebody defending school, opportunities, a variety of opportunities that school might provide, and you find by the time you're 18, you are no longer interested in yak herding, and you've, instead of investing in a quote-unquote education, you've invested all your time and resources into this pursuit, and then you decide you don't want to do it anymore.
Yes, so my response to that is, if you get a degree in something, you've already spent a lot of money, you've done that, right? You've limited yourself. And yes, by finishing high school, that would give me maybe some more options. But at least, I don't think I have that great of a defense to this. But right now, I don't think I will do anything else. Mm-hmm. And I am I'm not going to drop out of school instantly. I would like to graduate early, and I have a system to do that. Maybe we can explain that later, but let me say this. Because I don't really care. You know, maybe 20 or maybe 40-year-old Nick is going to be mad at me for doing this, but I think this is the morally correct way to do this. I think that if I'm going to have, as from an environmental aspect, this is the best way I can do without having an impact on the earth. And I think mm-hmm. that's something I'm somewhat passionate about. And also being independent. I don't care if 40-year-old Nick is going to be mad at me. I'm going to subject myself to this being poor, I guess, and growing my own food because it's the right thing to do. Not necessarily because it's the best in my best interest in living, I guess. Not for comfortability, but for moral reasoning.
Did you happen to hear any of the show? I think you said you did. The shows we did on the Autonomy Through Agorism series, mainly focused on permaculture.
Yes, I love those.
I'm glad to hear that, and I think what Jamin helped really, really explain with his contribution was that in this kind of pursuit, there's lessons that are certainly transportable to other areas of life. I mean, to be able to do what you're doing, you have to be an autodidact. You have to be a self-teacher, and I think if you're putting yourself through that process on a daily basis instead of kind of languishing or, you know, really languishing or worse in a public school where you're being fed information and you're going through essentially the same routine you've been going through when you were six, you're really just trudging through to get a piece of paper, to trudge through some more to get some more paper. And there really isn't a self-teaching process involved in that at all. So my counter to the person who says, well, but you're just a kid and you could totally change your mind. And then where will you be? You'll be prepared to do nothing. You're preparing yourself to do all kinds of things every day. You know, I mean, just the pursuit of permaculture connects to so many other important concepts and knowledge areas. So like your timing was perfect. I was actually preparing to do this series, I think, when you called into Free Talk Live. And I just thought it was the greatest story. So when you emailed me and said, I want to give you some updates at least, I was really excited to hear where things were at. And I think all that makes sense, right? Like, this is better preparation to be flexible and versatile in life than traditional schooling provides, right?
I guess I didn't really think about that. I suppose you're right. I don't have enough time to do, you know, branch out in my studies when I'm in school. Mm-hmm. In summer, I've been doing a lot of stuff. I can actually study things that I really want to, like economics and philosophy. Where in school, I had to stick to studying for an AP test and studying for the end of the semester test for all my other classes. Right, so I had to do all that homework, and I think some of it was busy work, some of it was helpful. Some of it I enjoyed, some of it was just tedious and terribly boring. But all in all, I don't think that it was great. I think I could learn on my own better, and I think that the path I am taking will allow me to learn more, like you said. I think that you're right. I've been able to do my own sort of show, and with that, I'm definitely learning more than I would in high school.
Yeah, you mean the podcast, which I definitely want to talk about in a minute here. Are you in any way concerned that continuing with school will make it impossible to pursue the yak herding and everything that comes with it?
Yes. Right now I am living with my parents and I have that to fall back on. I don't need to provide for myself right now. They do that for me. And I think that's why I want to get started now, is while I have that support from my parents, I should do it. But as soon as I graduate high school, I don't have that.
Right.
My parents might be kind enough to let me stay and pay rent, but right now I don't have to do that. I have a very relaxed life right now. And that's why I'm starting now, is I can do that and I have the support of my parents. And if I finished school and then started doing it, I wouldn't have that support.
A frequent guest on the show. Are you familiar with Jake DeSillis? Does that name ring a bell?
No, it doesn't.
He has a podcast. It's on LRN, and I would really recommend you check it out. It's called The Voluntary Life. Jake was a very successful entrepreneur who retired, I'm guessing, in his early 40s. And we gave a talk together a couple years ago, and he talked about, you know, really, this is an opportunity that you don't want to miss if you're interested in entrepreneurship in any form. You know, when you're a teenager and you have less responsibility, what a great time to try things and fail, right? Because I have like a threshold at 36 for how many things I can try and fail in a year. You know what I mean? And if you have a little bit more cushioning, just because, you know, that's how society works, and at your age, you're expected to go to school and live at home, that's really an opportunity that young people, more young people, should try to take advantage of. So it seems like you recognize all of that, and that's what you're trying to do. You actually see that there's a window here that you're trying to work within to get your footing to make this stable and make this successful, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But I want to go back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago about this plan you might have to leave school early, to actually graduate school early. And I talk to a lot of people who are very interested in leaving school, and there's a variety of levels of realisticness to it from the people I've talked to, but not everyone can do this, you know? I recognize that obviously that was one suggestion that I would at least ask people to look into when they listen to School Sucks podcasts, especially if they were in school. Can you get out? Can you get out and be successful and not strain family relationships and not cost yourself opportunities? Can you make a plan to do that? But if it can't be done, then it becomes an issue of school survival. One thing that has been neglected on the show is paths to early graduation. So if you've thought of one or researched one, I would actually like to hear about it.
Yeah, actually, project-based learning.
Okay.
My school has just implemented this year. This will be the first year they'll be doing this. And I put together a project proposal, and I'll be giving that at the end of the summer. And that would be my podcast. That's what I'm doing it for. I'm getting language arts credit and social studies credit for that. And so what the system that we had done, I can't remember exactly all the legality issues with it, but my father, he's actually the director of the charter school I go to. He really has been working on this because he'd like me to finish school, and so he kind of pushed that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other kids are interested in this, and I know people are doing it. And what I've figured out is doing a show takes some time, especially editing and if you're preparing an essay for what I do. So language arts, and that's a lot of hours, right? And that's what our school credits are based on hours. I don't know about anybody else's, but like for a class, you spend this many hours and that gives you a credit, right? That's how many hours you spend in class time, and I think some homework time they estimate. And if you do that, then you get that many hours. So you get that much credit for how many hours you do. So this is the idea, is that if you do this many hours on your project, then you can get a credit. And then if your product of your project is successful and it has met the requirements for a credit, then you get the credit.
Any skepticism or criticism of project-based learning going on in the school, especially since it's new, that you've heard?
Yes. Kids love it. They think it's great. Some of them would really like to do it. They just don't know what they can do as a project. Mm-hmm. And that's somewhat of an issue, is kids can't figure out what they would do. But the teachers, the ones that I've got, I've heard, is that it takes a lot of time for the teachers. There's some dispute over that. My teacher that I'm working with, I've talked to him twice, each for maybe half an hour. So altogether, it's probably taken an hour out of his time so far. And that's over the last 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a lot of teacher help there.
Yeah.
And so that's criticism. That's the only one I've really heard.
Yeah.
Teachers don't want to do it because they're afraid that it'll take too much time out of their hands.
Right. I understand that. And when I just read, a basic description of what it is, I think it's a really exciting alternative, obviously, to traditional rote learning. But there's been critics of that type of learning, like the traditional sit in a desk and copy things down and do what you're told and listen to the teacher. That model's been around for, in this country, 160 plus years at this point. And, you know, one of the biggest critics that came along just a couple generations into the system's existence was a guy named John Dewey. Have you heard of John Dewey?
I don't think so.
Well, John Dewey was Horace Mann, who was around about, or really active, about 50 years before Dewey was active or started being active, was called the father of public education, father of public schooling, right? And what he was credited with doing was taking the systems of schooling from Central Europe, which were very much about obedience, and bringing them to the United States, first to Massachusetts, and then when I think people in power started to see the opportunity that this type of schooling provided as a management tool, it spread from Massachusetts around the country very quickly. Dewey came along in the early 1900s, and he had a lot of criticisms about this kind of a system. And I have a lot of problems with Dewey. He was very much a socialist, and there was a lot of people like Dewey at the time who were basically looking for soft ways to scientifically manage the entire society. So then we fast forward 100 years, and we had people like, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates. Now, these are red flags for me. These is not obviously not proof of anything, you know, the merits or the dangers of project-based learning. These are just some initial thoughts that I have about it that obviously will require more research. So when I see like the Gateses are involved in it, my question or my possible research project shifts to attitudes and outcomes, or outcomes of attitudes, right? If project-based learning is going to replace traditional rote learning, why and who benefits? You know, I think that those are important questions. And one of the tenets of project-based learning, stated by Dewey 100 years ago and being stated now, is to essentially make people part of the community, right? To see their role within the larger collective, which can be dangerous. And I'm sure you've found that if you've been looking into philosophy, the dangers of that kind of thinking.
Yeah, collectivism.
Yeah, absolutely. So those were a couple red flags. I think if you just read about what project-based learning is as an alternative to like paper-based memorization, teacher-led, all of that, it's exciting. I would certainly be optimistic and enthusiastic about it just because it would be so much goddamn easier on students than the traditional models of schooling. But I just wanted to see what your thoughts were. Being in the middle of it right now and obviously being very alert and very skeptical.
I actually have not noticed that with project-based learning. I didn't even think about that, and that's interesting. And now that I think about it, it does have kind of a focus on community. As you have to have a community member, and you have to prove why it's helpful to people, which is
okay.
I didn't really think about that.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, there's nothing wrong with being a team player and, you know, being a pleasant part of a community, and there's certainly nothing wrong with helping people. But I would just want to know more. I mean, we were really focused on my show a while ago on outcomes-based education. And these were educational initiatives that probably started decades ago, but they really started ramping up in the early 90s, trying to produce certain attitudes and a certain level of predictability in students. And this is just a revamping. I mean, that's always been the goal of formal force schooling, is to get outcomes in attitudes, outcomes in belief, outcomes in ideology. But the world changes and the needs of those in power change as well. So, you know, you have to adjust once in a while. So you go from, you know, Goals 2000 to No Child Left Behind, to outcomes-based education, to Common Core. All of these are just like readjustments, you know, trying to get the product out of schools, be consistent with what, you know, powerful interests need it to be. I mean, schooling wouldn't be anything else. That's essentially, I think, what it boils down to. That's the intention of the schooling. But since you're in the middle of project-based learning and you're enjoying it and you're given this opportunity to get started with podcasting, which is awesome, I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So the project-based learning that you're doing creates the opportunity to do the podcast. What made you want to do the podcast and, you know, before this, and how did you go about learning to be a podcaster? Because I've listened to a few of your shows and they're pretty good.
Thank you. Actually, I was going to do a podcast before I was going to do the project. I got I won Michael Dean's, I won the Freedom Fiends mic contest. I was the next caller in it and they liked what I was saying, so they sent me a mic.
Very cool.
And I had wanted to start a podcast before that. I was kind of tired of writing essays for my blog because I didn't get enough attention for it. I didn't feel like I was reaching enough people. And mm-hmm. I figured, well, a podcast would be better. And Michael really helped me set that up. Now I have the opportunity to do that, and I really thank him for that. But yeah, he set me up with the mic. He walked me through the processes, you know, do a little bit of sound conditioning in my room and some little bit of mic technique, some audio editing, and making a website. So he got me started with that. And right along as that was starting to begin, this project-based learning opportunity came up, and I thought, well, I'm going to do this podcast anyway. And my dad said, well, you might as well get credit for it. So I was like, well, yeah, that's a great idea. So I decided I'm going to start this, see how I can get credit for it. I made a proposal, and that's how it got started.
How much was the message or the mission of the podcast scrutinized by who's ever advising you or overseeing you with the project-based learning?
Not at all.
Really?
My same world issues teacher is my project advisor. And
He's cool.
Extremely supportive of everybody's ideas, and he thinks what I'm doing is great.
And you've been doing the podcast now, what, a few months?
No, just about a month now, actually.
Yeah.
I have 5 shows out. I've done doing once a week.
And you've done some interviews, too. You've got some stuff on there. I heard a show with you and a British gentleman about conspiracy theories. I heard you on the Freedom Fiends a couple of times, and I think there was maybe one or two that I'm missing. And would you describe your show as having a niche?
Yeah, I guess right now at least I'm building a foundation of philosophy. I'm going deeper than most Liberty shows do, and I think that's important. And I'd like to stick with these ideas of building a foundation for your ideas and how that relates to a political philosophy.
Yeah, I really, that was one of the episodes that I listened to, building the foundation for a philosophy. And you went through the 5 branches of philosophy. And I thought that was a really great method. I wanted to talk first before we get into that. In fact, that could be a whole nother hour and a whole nother show. So we'll have to see where we're at here in a few minutes. But let's talk about skepticism, because I've heard you use words like extreme skepticism. And what does that mean to you? What comes with that for you, and how did you get there?
So critical thinking skills is, you know, my school is one of the few schools that actually teaches that, mm-hmm. which is, you know, great. And critical thinking skills is extremely important. You know, you have to be able to think on your own, and the only way to do that is to be skeptical and have critical thinking skills. So that's why I try to emphasize in that first podcast is being able to look at things skeptically. And I think there are different levels of skepticism. Like when I said extreme skepticism, I'm talking about what I call nihilism. It's a common misconception of what nihilism is, because nihilism is a very broad philosophy and it covers all branches.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really what nihilism is. It's just a very extreme form of skepticism mixed with human constructionism or social constructionism.
And so, sure.
I think that nihilism has a place, and I go over this in my podcast, is that since it is a very extreme form of skepticism, I think that it is great to start with that, being extremely skeptical, asking why is this true, and why is that true, until you get to a point which is called the Munchausen trilemma.
Okay.
And that point is where you either start using the, well, I guess you don't really start, but using the regressive argument, which is just keep arguing and arguing for a foundation. You give a foundation for your foundation forever.
Mm-hmm.
Or you use a circular argument, or you just rely on a foundation of faith.
Okay. So we will get into that. We're going to, I'm going to put a bookmark right there for now, because you, you said,
sorry,
no, that's fine. That's great. Because I certainly have a lot to say about that. You mentioned that your school teaches critical thinking skills. I would like to hear what that means to you first, and how do they do that?
The places where I really got that were from my world issues class and from language arts, mm-hmm. my English literature class. Both these teachers were teaching us about that. And I also took the debate elective, which got into that too. But not everybody took that elective. The one that the English teacher, he was the main one who really started actually talking about critical thinking and giving us these kind of rules of rhetoric, right? That triangle, that's all I can remember from that.
The rhetorical?
Yes, rhetorical triangle.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar.
And so he showed us how to use these argument skills, like typical logical fallacies, and you have to watch out for those. He gave us an assignment where we had to look at ads and what kind of logical fallacies they used, like emotional appeals, and he taught us where you should really look out for those and why those work so well.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main thing, and I think that was really great what he did there. And then for global issues, it was sort of the same thing. We all had different ideas in the class. We all presented them, and we all had to think kind of, where are people wrong? I guess he didn't say anybody was wrong, but we had to look skeptically at these things, and he showed us videos and stuff. He asked for our thoughts, and he kind of built our arguments up and showed where we might be wrong. And that whole discussion, having an open discussion on different people's ideals, is very strong in critical thinking. You have to think about, well, is this person right? And you have to look at all those, you have to get kind of deep with it. You have to be skeptical on, is this person telling the truth? Why is it true? Why isn't it true? And I think that is really what taught us critical thinking skills at school.
All right, so let me ask you this. In one of your podcasts, you were talking about skepticism, and you said you have to draw a line, right, eventually somewhere. So what does it mean to be right? You said just tell if somebody is right or not. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And that's what I mean by extreme skepticism is you don't really know. We don't know, I guess. But we get to that Munchausen trilemma. We just don't know if anybody's right or not. What is the truth? When you look at that, you don't know. But that's really kind of impractical to think about. You kind of have to draw a line of faith, a line with skepticism, on where you decide, this is my foundation, and according to my foundations, is this person right?
So would you say that we can't know anything?
Yes.
Okay. There is
no absolute knowledge.
Okay. So from there, my question, as as it was with the last guest I had, where we had a similar conversation, how familiar are you with the philosophy of objectivism?
I know a little bit about it. I've been trying to get an objectivist on the show, but
okay, I'm not the best person to do that, but I would introduce the concept. I'm not maybe introducing you. I'm asking what you would think of the word axiom. What does that mean to you?
I don't really know. What I immediately think is it's a true statement. That's just what I think, because I've never really looked at the definition.
Right. So essentially shorthand, and this is not a dictionary definition, there's no way to undo it. There's no way to defeat it. And really, the trick here with axioms is that an axiom is essentially a proposition that if you want to argue against something, right, you actually need to use that thing that you want to argue against in any attempt to argue against it or deny it, right? So an example of this would be something like existence. Would you say that we exist?
Well, that's what, there's two sides that I take, right? If you want me to take the extreme skeptic side, which would disagree and say, I don't know.
Okay. What would be the other side?
Is that, yes, it seems that I exist, so I'm going to believe I exist.
All right. So in objectivism, let's back up a little bit here. Okay, so we go through the five branches of philosophy: metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, politics, aesthetics, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when we're starting to use the word nihilism, right, you can see where people start to say, uh-oh, because in certain parts of philosophy, like I would say ethics and politics, nihilism gets pretty dangerous, right?
Or it can. Yes.
So what I'm guessing is that, and I think I heard this in the podcast, you go through metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics, just a refresher for the people who might be rusty on this stuff, the question of what exists. Epistemology, how do I know that, essentially? Is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's very easy, I think, and one of the appeals of objectivism for me initially, now I don't stand by this anymore, was that it appeared to be a full, complete, closed philosophy, that through all five branches, it initially looked like it was consistent. And I don't believe that because I think Rand and the people who follow her drop the ball on politics, right? They talk about free market capitalism, but not anarcho-capitalism. So it's very difficult to, coming from an objectivist point of view, to hear this, the relativism or subjectivity or no objective truth arguments, because it seems to me like it's using a fallacy called the stolen concept. Are you familiar with that?
No.
That you're essentially having to use, you're having to employ the thing that you want to argue against, right? So if there is a claim made by a relativist or a nihilist, it essentially requires the existence of objective truth to make that claim. Otherwise, there's at least, and I want to learn, right? Because I could totally be missing something here. It doesn't seem like there's any point, you know? Like, if we can't have knowledge, what could we ever understand? How could we ever get wisdom? And if the answer to all those questions is it's impossible, then what's the point? And I guess that's nihilism carried out through all five branches of philosophy. But I really like objectivism in that it sets as axioms, we exist, we're conscious of that existence, and we can use our consciousness to identify what exists inside it. I just haven't been able to understand why any other approach would have any point. Like, what do you do next? If you don't accept those things, what do you do next?
So yeah, that's where I make my line of skepticism. Where I draw that line is it is impractical, but when it's not practical, it isn't practical at all to live like that. It isn't practical to think, well, I don't exist, or maybe I don't exist. You do assume you exist, and you are conscious of that existence, right? That is an assumption that every person makes, and you cannot get away with that, from that. But when we look at things from a purely philosophical and logical view, my answer to that is it's a paradox. Like what you're saying is we have to use the stolen concept fallacy. When I say it's impossible to know whether you exist, you have to exist to be able to say that. Well, sure, that makes sense, but it's a paradox because you don't really know that you need to know that you exist to be able to say that you don't exist. It's very confusing. I understand if this doesn't make sense because it's a paradox. It's self-contradictory, but it holds some truth.
Well, you said to me that, or you said in your podcast that the branch of philosophy that you're most interested in is in politics, right?
Yes.
So when we set up our metaphysics and our epistemology like this, like let's say even if objectivism, like let's just say hypothetically that I don't know if that really works or not. I don't really see any other way to go forward, because when you get to ethics and you get to politics and you've done, metaphysics and an epistemology in a way where there is no objective truth, you're setting up some real shitstorms, and history has demonstrated that. All through the 19th and 20th century in Central Europe with German idealism
And the biggest problem, I talked about this recently on a show with Thaddeus Russell, is if you don't have that philosophical container set, that the truth is knowable, that the truth is attainable, that you can use your five senses and then use reason to arrive at an objective truth, well, I guess, you know, you're really just kind of relying on the authorities, you know? And if that's your ethics, what are your politics? Well, they showed up, you know, in the 20th century. So I can't make anybody an objectivist, and I don't try, and I don't like most people who call themselves objectivists. But I at least encourage people to, once they start on a path of philosophical discovery, check out the Ayn Rand. I wouldn't start with like reading Atlas Shrugged or something like that. You know, it's an interesting book, but the characters are all just sort of these philosophical carriers, right? They don't really have any depth. They don't really have any dimension. They're just delivery systems for Ayn Rand's philosophy. So it wouldn't, if you're trying to get into Ayn Rand, I don't know if I'd start there, but I don't think anyone should be trying to get into Ayn Rand, by the way. I think that people should, if they have an appetite for philosophy, maybe a good place to start would be, you know who Stefan Molyneux is?
Yes.
Free Domain Radio. He did a series years ago called Introduction to Philosophy. And I think he would self-describe as an objectivist. But if you've decided to go down a different philosophical path, I would at least try to balance it with an understanding or an exploration into the basic tenets of objectivism. Because the same thing happened for me. Like, I got into all of this through politics, right? I was studying history, and then that just kind of translated into an interest in, you know, what was going on in modern times. It really ramped up when Ron Paul entered the political primaries in 2007, and I had been listening to Free Talk Live around that time. So my interest in politics was increasing. So that's where I start. But one of the things that was very confusing, especially with the study of history, is where the hell did all this, why, how did this happen? How did these people in Germany allow, you know, the Third Reich to rise to the level of power and destruction that it did? What happened in Eastern Europe with the Soviet Union? What's happening in the United States today? And they had a very dangerous sort of relativistic philosophy that was transferred here by the school system that came from Prussia, that came from Central Europe. And when I started to learn all of this, things politically started to make a lot more sense. And if you describe yourself as like an anarcho-capitalist just from a consequentialist point of view, that it's a, you know, a subjective preference, and you think it's what's best for you, I totally understand that. But from studying history and seeing the dangers of people rejecting the idea of truth, it's at least worth, if you're interested in history, if you're interested in politics, you know, and you've got all the time in the world to do it, it would be at least worth investigating objectivism. It really helped like sort things out for me. And I have problems with it. I certainly have problems with it. It is not the complete closed philosophy that I think people like Rand and Peikoff, Leonard Peikoff, who was like the heir to the Ayn Rand objectivist empire kind of thing. It's not the closed, complete philosophy that they promised, but when it comes to metaphysics and epistemology, it's definitely something that's worth looking at. And ethics, it's definitely something that's worth looking at.
And I completely agree with you, actually. And like, what I try and make a point is, you know, I do identify as a nihilist, from a philosophical standpoint. I am philosophically a nihilist, but practically, I'm an objectivist. I do assume that I exist, and I do assume that the non-aggression principle is ethically right, but I don't really, if I understand what moral objectivism is, I don't really agree with that there is these moral principles that we all must abide by. I think it's all in self-interest, and the best, if we look at ethics from a point of what is the best way to live rather than what is the morally right way to live, because I don't think there is such a thing as morals. It just, objectively at least, that doesn't really make sense to me. But there is a self-interest, and I think that people's self-interest is connected. I think that we all kind of have that same self-interest where we should live and coexist peacefully in a way that we don't have to harm each other. I think that is in everybody's self-interest, and that's why I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I think the best way to do that is through a free market, privatized system, completely privatized.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, the part about being practically an objectivist, because these are all the, I had this conversation, I don't know, are you familiar with Thaddeus Russell, the historian? And he was talking.
I love him on your show. I haven't heard him otherwise.
Well, in the last show we did, he was talking about not believing in objective truth. And as I edited the show, the show had a different point, so I didn't want to stray off into that, because we never would have gotten to what I wanted to talk about. And yeah, I have a lot of confidence in my audience to deal with that, even if I don't. But as I listened to it a couple of times, I was really kind of pissed. I was like, I should have said something. And, you know, just bringing language like cause and effect into it, or asking him, when you talk about practically being objectivist, if I had asked him, well, okay, do you test your philosophy in your work and in your personal life? or do you live like with some kind of objective standard? Because I think in the study of philosophy, we can kind of get, I know this happened to me. I got like pulled out of my world when I first started to look into it. And I really found objectivism to be helpful in at least helping me make sense of my experience and my learning. Are you familiar with something called the Trivium?
No, I've been meaning to listen to those shows you made.
Oh, okay. Well, you could probably even find, like, I mean, that's like a 5-hour time investment. I recommend it. But the Trivium is, you know, Latin for where three roads meet. And this goes back thousands of years to ancient Greece. But it lines up with a lot of objectivism pretty well. And it's essentially three steps, we could say, to attaining knowledge. Inputting, like you have things that come in, and then you process them just like a computer, input, process, output. So in the Trivium, the first step is called grammar, right? So grammar are the individual pieces of knowledge that we use to eventually go to the second, which is logic, right? So we take the things we know, right? And we start to work with those things to develop consistency and remove contradiction. And that's from grammar to logic. And the third part of the Trivium is rhetoric, where we take what we know, the understanding that we've gained from the individual pieces of knowledge, and we apply it, right? And that's wisdom, knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And just as an example, you were doing a show, I was listening to the show on conspiracy theories. Who was that guy? What was his name? Bernie?
Yeah, Bernie Green, Life, okay. Liberty, and Proper Tea.
Yeah, I enjoyed your conversation with him, and you're talking about conspiracies, and he brought up this one that McDonald's, and I'll let you explain this, but I'm just gonna introduce it like this. McDonald's is poisoning its customers.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the conspiracy theory there?
Basically that McDonald's is, I think it was purposefully poisoning its customers by giving them crappy food. I mean, not just crappy food, but intentionally making it harmful to people's health by putting whatever chemicals in it.
Right. So if we were going to apply like a basic Trivium kind of process to the proposition that McDonald's is poisoning its customers, the first thing that I would want to know a lot more about is what is poisoning, right? Because it's used in the presentation of a conspiracy, maybe there's some excitement and some sexiness that's added, like McDonald's, popular fast food chain McDonald's, is poisoning their customers. Well, are people dying as they're pulling out of the drive-through? Are their bodies inside? Do they die when they get home? Do they die the next day? Are they choking? Like, what does poisoning mean, right? If by poisoning we mean that people ingest something and die, McDonald's is not poisoning their customers. But you see how muddy the water of that debate can get very quickly if we're not clear on a piece of knowledge called poisoning, right? Logic, whatever kind of logic you do after that, doesn't really matter if the people involved in that debate don't agree on what poisoning is, right? Maybe we discover through a pursuit of knowledge that poisoning isn't the right word to use there, right? It's empirical that eating McDonald's food every day doesn't produce a higher quality of life from a health standpoint, but it's kind of hyperbolic to call it poisoning, right?
Yeah.
So like clearing up a word like that, because then it's just a wash, right? And the debate becomes, McDonald's is poisoning their customers. No, they're not. I went there yesterday and I'm alive, right? You've just got a mess. But if poisoning, that piece of knowledge, is expanded to actually mean, like, you can get an agreement on a definition of what McDonald's is doing to their customers, if anything, maybe you can have a more thoughtful debate, right? Then maybe you can go through a logical process that leads to a presentation that might convince somebody for or against the merits of McDonald's. So the trivium is the critical thinking process. And what's important about the trivium is, you know, people who want to control other people and scientifically manage society, they've understood it all along, right? And ordinary people haven't. So it's definitely, it's your mind wants to naturally do it anyway, but it's something that if we learn, we can use not only to do what you're doing, right? Where you're going out every day and you're trying to learn new things that help you, that serve you, and that's great. But we can also use it to defend ourselves, like logical fallacies, which you talked about learning in school.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that trivium is actually great, because I do understand that defining terms is extremely important, and I think you're exactly right. I think that organization method of the trivium is brilliant.
So would you come back and do like a whole nother discussion, a whole nother philosophy discussion?
Absolutely.
I'm trying to think of, maybe we could do like a round table where I certainly know somebody who can very thoughtfully and very peacefully explain objectivism much better than I can. That might be a fun thing. Maybe we could do that in the near future. But I would definitely love updates on how things are going for you, Nick. And the podcast, what's the title?
Oh, yeah, Anarcho-Yakitalism Podcast.
Love it. Love it. Okay. And the site is an-yak.com.
an-yak.com.
So what's coming up?
Right now I'm actually putting together a podcast. I did a interview with my friend Scott Kersey on ethics, and we talk about exactly what we talked about today, with drawing a line with skepticism and where ethics play a role with that.
Well, I'm going to continue to listen, and you know, I look forward to the new stuff you have coming out. I really have to say, I'm really excited. I was really excited months ago when I first heard what you were trying to do. And I'm really excited to see where it goes. And now I'm more excited to see that you're actually documenting it for all of us. I hope you're going to provide somewhat regular updates on your site with the school leaving process and the development of the yak herding.
Yeah, I think I'll do that.
So we could leave it like this. In maybe the next few weeks or a month, we can try to put together a roundtable where we can focus a little bit more on philosophy. I certainly wanted to just use today to introduce you to my audience and to say I'm really excited about what you're doing, and I look forward to seeing what's next.
Yeah, thanks.